Hi, this is Leonard Peikoff here to apply Ayn Rand's philosophy of objectivism to your real-life questions. My responses cover subjects of general interest, such as human relationships, career, and morality, but not current politics. For the present, my answers are posted every other week on Mondays, and Dr. Yaron Brook answers questions on current events on the alternate Mondays. You can listen to full episodes on iTunes or listen to single questions or full episodes on my website. Several years of podcasts are now easily searchable by topic or keywords. If you have a philosophical question to ask, simply go to www.peikoff.com, and that's spelled P as in Peter, E-I-K-O-F-F, like the word off at the end, peikoff.com. And of course, feel free to follow me on Facebook and Twitter. If a real Galt's Gulch existed, would you like to live there year-round or only part of the year? There's a few other questions on that, but first let me answer that. If you're talking philosophically, certainly I'd like to live there year-round. In other words, a rational society with moral people who have creative, productive lives. Absolutely. But that does not mean I wouldn't want to visit Europe or Asia or have a vacation in a different climate, etc. I'm not bound to that particular ground. So it depends whether you're talking real estate or philosophy. Then the question goes on, who would you most like to get to meet there? Well, of course, everybody. But if I had to pick one, I'd pick that girl who was fishing off the pier and looking after Galt hopelessly. And the reason is that that was Ayn Rand's putting herself into the novel. You know, Alfred Hitchcock, older of you may know, was a director. And he always had a couple of seconds in every one of his movies where he was shown either boarding a train or coming down the stairs or whatever. Well, that was her Alfred Hitchcock touch. And just to show you how, whether you call it naive or stupid, I was a teenager at the time. And she said to me, "What did I think of that? And how come I didn't get it?" And my immediate words that I blurted out were, "But you said it was a young woman." And she was, I think, in her 40s at the time. But, you know, to me, anybody over 30 was already near the end. It's not exactly a gracious reply, but I always remembered that. And then the other question, no, two more on that. What would you ask him or her? Well, seriously, I would pick Axton as the one that I would most like to meet. And I'd like to ask him what he thinks is Ayn Rand's greatest achievement, knowing that he would understand all the issues. And even more than that, what does he think of DIM, my book, The DIM Hypothesis? I know he has to like the other books I wrote, but this one was never seen by anybody like Ayn or any other philosopher that she had confidence in. I have confidence in, but I would be fascinated to know what he would think, but that's not of general interest. Now, a completely different question. Do you think there is any value in visiting the graveside of a loved one? Well, I certainly don't think it's obligatory, but yes, I think there can be value depending upon the context. I have actually done that a couple times in my life. Least significant, I did it for one of my cats that I really loved, and that was actually at Ayn Rand's suggestion. The cat, the dead cat, died of a disease. It was with the vet, and I told her that he was there. He had just died, and she said, "Why leave him there? Give him, you know, a permanent place where you can go." So I rushed to save the body and put him up with another cat that I had in a grave in Long Island, I think with a picture. And I went back there once, but, you know, not after that. I started having dogs. Nevertheless, I'm glad he has that little marker, and he still has a little definable place that I know of. And now, a couple of times, to be serious, I went to Ayn Rand's grave several years apart. And I went to some other people, but I asked to be alone for a while, and they moved away. And I don't know what you think of this. I talked to her aloud. Actually, the way you would talk to another person, looking at the gravestones, telling her the highlights of everything that had happened that would be relevant to her interests, and what I had accomplished, and any questions and doubts that I had. I knew perfectly well that, you know, I wasn't talking to her, but her presence was a little more real when I knew that her remains were literally right in front of me. And it made it easier, in effect, to fantasize and to speak my mind as though to her. It was acting, but it was acting that I found cathartic and helpful. I went away not feeling, you know, well, I've talked to her, but feeling I've said the kind of things I would say to her if she were alive. And so from that point of view, I definitely got something out of it. Not that I remembered her. It wasn't, I'll never forget her. I don't need to visit anything for that, but that I could talk as though to her, which is a unique experience in terms of what she is. Now, another question. These are all from the same person. Is there any value to the practice of forgiveness? Do you believe it frees one from resentment and anger? As a common idea, you don't want to carry anger and rage around with you. And the only way to get rid of it is to say, okay, I forgive you. It didn't really matter what you did. And I think that is a completely false alternative. Forgiveness, in any rational sense, has to be earned. The person has to be able to explain what they did. They have to be able to make reparations. And they have to show you that they will not behave that way again. And that is a big load. So forgiveness is a very demanding thing before you give it rationally. And in most cases, forgiveness is just, you know, thrown off as though, okay, let's forget about it. Now, there's a lot of things, you know, if you use forgiveness for lighter offenses, there's a lot of things that it's fine to say, I forgive you. Like you spilled water on a tablecloth. Accidentally, you say to the hostess, oh, I'm sorry, please forgive me. That's not an issue of injustice. You don't have to show her that you'll pay for the tablecloth or, you know, change your character. But we're talking about the kind of sin or behavior that would sentence you to lifelong resentment and anger. And forgiveness is supposed to be the answer to that. It cannot be the answer to that, because it's not deserved. So however much you say, if a man ran over your child and did it because he was drunk, well, I don't want to carry that resentment and anger with me all my life, so I forgive you. You cannot believe that, unless it's just words and you didn't attach that much significance to your child. You're lying to yourself if you say, okay, forgiveness means you're different, et cetera, et cetera. But here, there's no reparations. Here, there's no indication that you're changed your character. Here, all I know is you've taken irreplaceable value, and I'm enraged, and there's no way that saying forgive you is going to make you feel better. It just makes you feel like a liar to yourself for adding that in. Now, let me just add this. Does that mean that if the person doesn't earn forgiveness, you have to carry a resentment and rage around as part of your, for the rest of your life? No, and I think it's important to understand. The way that you carry it around is to metaphysically devalue it. In other words, you always know what that person did, and that they are a swine, and that you don't tolerate it and all the grief they caused. But after the passage of time, maybe 1 year, 3 years, you are able, if you have the right ideas, to say, that was a very, very, very wicked thing, but that is not reality. I'm not going to let that determine how I feel about the rest of the world, about my goals, about other people, etc. If you can do that, then it becomes an issue of, occasionally, you will remember what the person did, but it won't be part of your continuous inner feeling. And actually, if you do that correctly without repression, you get to the point where you really don't care. At the beginning, somebody does that, you want revenge, put them in jail for life, whatever. But if you follow this, I've seen this in a number of cases. I'm sorry to say in my own case also, if certain people have behaved so wickedly that when it first started, I sincerely thought if it was legal, I would kill them. Yeah, justice would demand that. I was very hard about it. And then it's not that what they did pales, it's no longer an active part of my view of the world. So it no longer is resentment and anger as a, you know, key part of my psychology. And the actual result was a couple of these people, showing that there's a merciful God, died recently, not through my hand. And I didn't even feel happy that they finally got it. It didn't make any difference to me at all at that point. Not just because it was long ago, but because it was, in effect, like another world. I was back in reality, and the issue was closed. So I didn't carry the resentment and anger through my life, although it was very, very intense at the time it took place. Would you consider it cowardly or a breach of integrity for a Hollywood actor to conceal his objectivist beliefs if divulging them would be detrimental to his ability to land movie roles? It's absolutely proper. There is no deception whatever on this case. The producer, whoever hired you, didn't put out a bulletin saying, we only want communists, or we only want supporters of Jeb Bush in this movie. And that's, you know, this is a Jeb Bush movie. And so if you come, that's the conditions. Then I would say you shouldn't do it. You don't want to propagate Jeb Bush, and anybody who doesn't like Jeb Bush, practically speaking, will not like you, therefore, anyway. But it is not deception for you to withhold from someone who has no right to know that information about you. Only if you are in a situation where you are asked outright, do you believe this? That is a condition. But what these people do is just what the college administrators and deans do. Well, we are wide open. You know, we want everybody of every persuasion. We never be prejudiced against any group. But and of course, they have a secret agenda. And as soon as they get a whiff that you don't agree with the consensus, you know, the cabbage was invented by women and all the rest of it, you're fired or you're not hired. So I would not let them get away with the pretense. You are making them live up to their claim of receptivity to talent, regardless of what. So I wouldn't feel the least question that you were cowardly or violating your moral principles. Now, a question about indefinite life extension. In other words, permanently stopping or reversing aging in a person. And the question says, this may become a reality within this century. That wouldn't make a person indestructible, he goes on, but it could allow them to live for hundreds of years, as long as they never encounter a severe disease or traumatic injury. And I would add, or an irrational society which can destroy anything, or even a whole life of evasion, drug addiction, all the rest of it. You know, so the ways of self-destruction that are possible, let alone social destruction by others, are huge. So if you're indestructible, it means there's nothing biological that would require you to die in their 70s or 30s or whatever it be. Now, he says, it seems that most of the opposition to this idea comes from religionists and anti-technology leftists. What is your take? Of course, I think that would be fine. You can live hundreds of years, and especially, you say, if you can go back, I wouldn't mind going back, at a conservative estimate, 60 years. If I could go back 60 years, I think I'd be happy. Not 70, but 60. What is the conceivable negative side of that? Maybe the government is upset because they have to pay more and more Social Security, but that's going bankrupt anyway. I see absolutely no negative, only good to that, particularly if it's coupled with the right to voluntary suicide, assisted suicide. So that if a person doesn't want to go on for hundreds of years, it's not mandatory. I might just close by saying that Victor Hugo had a cute thing. He said, 200 years, that's the ideal lifespan, just long enough to get everything on paper. And for a writer, I think that's a good number. But of course, it's up to each person. Thank you. If you want to know more about Ayn Rand's philosophy, I invite you to ask me a question. I can't answer them all, but I do read them all. Just write to leonard@peekoff.com. And if you haven't already done so, start by reading Ayn Rand's two most important novels, The Fountainhead and Atlas Shrugged. And I might add that it wouldn't hurt you to read my latest book, The Dim Hypothesis.